Hello and welcome back to Millennial. And I'm now here with Bubba Kate, as she's known in some quarters. Kate, welcome to Millennial. Why don't you introduce yourself to the audience?
Good evening, Rose. Happy Millennial. I'm Bubba Kate, or otherwise known as Paris on Telegram, or Katie Elizabeth Fanning. That's my real name. I have pseudonyms online, as everybody does. Do you want me to sort of describe what I am? That's really difficult to do.
keep it fairly limited to just the stuff that's relevant.
A pissed off citizen turned dissident nationalist activist. I actually tried to drop out of the political sphere for some time and go to university, but the anti-white agenda just becomes too much to handle and you have to oppose it somewhat. So I've yet again entered into trying to do something about it. So I think I could be called a nationalist dissident. I think that's how we can describe it.
Yeah, I think that sounds right. I mean, how far back does your involvement go in politics?
Well, I first started really taking an interest in politics kind of like 2010. And I was one of those people that went down the conspiracy rabbit hole and I came across Alex Jones and InfoWars. And I watched a lot of his content. And from there, I came across Paul Joseph Watson and the UK Independence Party. And I joined the UK Independence Party in 2014, right at the beginning of it. And then I actually became an active member quite quickly and helped to set up a branch in the local area, helped to run an election campaign, got involved in the referendum, ended up as one of their directors and the deputy to their youth wing. And then after the referendum, UKIP seemed to have expired its purpose. I tried to push it more towards the right, talking about grooming gangs and things like that. We got Gerald Batten, but obviously there was that coup and all these people got chucked out. I got called by some people that I worked with in the referendum saying, help us in the Conservative Party to get Brexit done. Otherwise, you know, Jeremy Corbyn is going to trash our plans and we're going to stay in the European Union. So I assisted them in that campaign. Please forgive me. I had no idea they were going to be as terrible as they were. I mean, you do get told never trust a Tory. And from there, I thought, right, I've had enough of politics. It clearly doesn't work. We don't actually live in a democracy. You know, Labour and Tories are the two sides of the same communist shekel, and we know who rules them. I thought, right, what I'm going to go do is I'm going to go study law. One, because I've been denied personal justice, and that's, won't go into that this evening. But also, the injustices that I see day in, day out, living in a diverse inner city area, the homelessness, the decay, the despair, the lack of community cohesion, lack of identity of all white people that I come across. It's just, it becomes too much to bear. So, you know, after a while, you know, even at university, there was a lot of anti-whiteness and that led to some complaints that led to a legal case that, again, led to me being known in the political sphere because not many white people are really challenging these things through the courts, especially independently as a litigant in person. But also I've decided to challenge some of the problems that are going on, but you can't do this independently so much. So I've decided to set up a community interest company called the White Indigenous Rights Alliance. It's a very complex organization. There is a video about it called An Introduction to the Alliance that's on my YouTube page that goes into all of it in detail. But I'm setting this up so that we have an organisation, because there's none in the UK at all, none. No charities or nothing that are there purely for the interests of the white Indigenous population, even though they are suffering the highest rates of deaths of despair, suicide. They are the group that have lowest attainment in education, going on into higher education, and it's all the way through education from early years right up until university. We know that white people are the majority of the homeless population that we see on our streets, you know, that are freezing in this weather, but yet we're paying billions to house. Well, what is it now? How many thousands of hostile fighting age men do we have in hotels? That's the question.
This is, I think, perhaps it gets worse and worse, you know, every year. And but I think the thing that's become apparent this year is the stuff about keep putting them up in hotels. I mean, I wouldn't make this up. You know, it's so egregious. And you can't quite believe it. You know, they're actually in four and five star hotels. You know,
the level of insult is unreal, isn't it? I remember years ago, though, reading a story about a gentleman that took part in this military operation. And there was a terrorist involved. He managed to get out of it. You probably know which one I'm talking about, but I can't actually recall the exact event that it was. But special forces were used, and they went into this siege, and they killed most of the terrorists. One of them got out. He then claimed asylum in this country and was given like £1 million council flat. And this gentleman that used to be in the military that took part in the siege, that was a hero, was sleeping homeless on the same street. And we now see this repeated across the country, where there are men from the indigenous white population who, for whatever reason, have fallen on hard times. And it can happen to anybody. I know a lot of people assume that the homeless are either drug addicts or you know, have drinking problems. But a lot of these men have just had relationship problems and have had to leave the home because they've broken up with their missus, or they've lost their job and they can no longer pay their rents, or the cost of living has got so high that they literally cannot afford their mortgages. And this is happening to a lot of people. And yet there is no help for white people, none whatsoever. I mean, if you fall on hard times, you're back of the housing list. And there's so many refugees waiting for houses. You're never going to get one as a white male, or even as a white female now, even if you've got dependents. I mean, what level of, how can you put it, humiliation are we going to put up with? I mean, I've gone to the shops today to finish some Christmas shopping, and there was white men begging for change outside these shops, and Africans walking past them with trolleys full of food, you know, going into their cars, latest phones in the hand. And you know that these people couldn't afford to live a month in our country. Even if they had a good job back in Africa and had full-time wages, the disparity between our economies, they couldn't live a month in one of our countries. So we know that we're paying for that with our taxes. We know that Serco are getting contracts, right, to get houses, rental houses, private rentals. They'll give the landlords 5 years worth of rent, 5 years worth of bills. So they want to push out the white tenants onto the street, even though there's nowhere for them to go, because they want to house Ukrainian refugees and Indians and refugees and all these Afghanis and all the hostile fighting age men coming over in dinghies. God, it irritates you. And that's why I've decided to set up the White Indigenous Rights Alliance, because there are no charities helping white people. There is nothing that looks after the interests of our people. There is nothing that's litigating for our people. Nobody's, you know, conducting judicial reviews to contest decisions by Parliament or by the courts that really undermine our rights to existence as white people. And this is what got me from going, right, that's it, I'm going to boycott politics, to going, actually, no, I'm not going to boycott politics. What I'm going to do is I'm going to stop pretending that politicians are going to do something for our people, and I'm not going to ask permission. I'm just going to do it myself. So that's what I'm doing now.
Yes, I remember saying to you at some point, sometimes it's best just to do things yourself rather than wait for other people to do it. And, you know, people can mean well, and, you know, but sometimes they can help or try to help, and it just ends up getting in the way. I don't know. I'm not saying please never offer help. I'm just saying sometimes it's best to just do things yourself. And I think with our movement, something that we, and this is international, this problem, we don't have a legal organization. And this means that, you know, the mainstream and our opposition can, you know, screw us around, can deny us things, punish us.
One thing that I've learned is, you know, I a lot of nationalists are facing persecution, right? We see it all the time. There are kids that are being prosecuted for terrorism, for owning books that they can buy off of Amazon, people being harassed by the police for sharing music, even though, you know, drill musicians can rap about people that they've murdered and people that they want to kill. That's fine. So I've looked at it, and the judicial system is highly corrupt. But in this country, we have constitutional rights that are uncoded, but they are fundamental to our legal system. People aren't fighting through our legal system because they think they can't win, which sometimes I believe is right if you're going to be using some barristers and solicitors, because they're swearing oaths, right, to diversity and inclusivity and all of this nonsense, all of these left-wing agendas. So you can't get much justice through them, because they'll tell you, oh, this case won't get anywhere. This won't hold any merit. Well, that's going to be questionable, isn't it, once you get some competent litigants in person, once people are trained. This is one of the things that the White Indigenous Rights Alliance is going to do. I'm going to have a legal education hub, which is going to teach people how to independently access their legal rights, because our constitutional right to unimpeded access to justice is being undermined, not only by so-called Acts of Parliament and legislation, which it can't do, according to Lord Diplock. I think it's in the Attorney General versus the Times of 1974. That case is where he says that any Act of Parliament, even any order of the court, can't impede our constitutional right to access to justice. But as we've seen with my case and with the case that's being brought forward by, what's her name, Amy something, the one against the Travestock Institute, the NHS, for their anti-white and anti-Christian discrimination. She's had to like crowdfund like £200,000 to bring a case forward.
Well, this is the thing. Legal stuff costs a fortune. You know, our opposition know this, and they're not afraid of it at all. They've got infinite funds, really, especially the corporations and whatever. But I think for us, it's like a lot of us are ordinary people. We've got no experience of this. We don't realize quite what we're up against and the resources that are necessary in order to mount
a defense. To do it.
Yes, I know, but you have this is what I'm saying. I think other people don't realize what's involved. Why do you talk about
it? I underestimated the amount of work that was involved and how difficult it is as in an average citizen to access your legal rights until I really attempted to do so at very short notice. Trying to access legal databases, you can't do as a citizen. You've got to pay a subscription to access things like Westlaw or Lexis, whereas your opposition is going to have access to this. Only if you're extremely poor or on benefits are you going to be able to access legal aid, and that's becoming more and more limited. Even in criminal cases and family law cases, they're leaving people unrepresented. And I would say that the judicial system really isn't looking after litigants in person. They hate the idea of people independently accessing their legal rights, but they know that they can try and intimidate people out of doing so. I mean, obviously the tactics didn't work with me, and they wouldn't even let me crowdfund. And I just thought, you know what, I think that I will be able to bring this forward because I know that my legal basis for bringing this forward is meritous and correct within law. So most of the obstacles of really finding things like the right forms and knowing what to do next. I mean, everything's written in legalese. But what I would like to do is have some sort of educational basis that can teach people how to independently access their legal rights. I want to teach people what their rights are as Indigenous peoples of Great Britain, as their own unique racial, ethnic, national and religious groups. These things are going to be fundamental to our people. The Our Rights Division of the White Indigenous Rights Alliance has a policy research and advisory hub that's going to look into policy and legislation by government or even private institutions that impacts the rights and lives of the white Indigenous peoples. And we will produce reports on that. But the Alliance Watch, now this is our litigation department, if you like. This is going to have an investigations department, which will also have, in some cases, a litigations department that will bring forward judicial reviews of policy and legislation that Parliament brings forward. Like, take, for example, our Indian Prime Minister wishing to give amnesty to all the illegal foreigners that have come here, granting them citizenship. We could challenge that in a court of law. Now, judicial reviews are expensive. What I'm doing right now as a litigant in person, I can do independently myself. But if I want to bring forward big cases like judicial reviews, I'm going to need the backing of an organisation and the funding to do that. It's like £5,000 just to file the claims with the courts. So that's why I need an organisation like the White Indigenous Rights Alliance, because we need to come together as a cohesive community to help fund these kind of activities. I need people with more experience than myself and these skill sets to help. You know, if you're somebody out there who realizes what's going on in this country and you've got legal expertise, please do get in touch with me. Because these are the sorts of skills that we're going to need. As Rose has just said, nobody is litigating for us. And it is possible. We do have law and case law on our side. We have justice that we can implement. It's just nobody's really trying. But if we come together as a cohesive community to use our skills, if we will help fund this kind of thing, we can start challenging things in government seriously, or even bringing forward private prosecutions for corrupt constabularies that ignore things like Muslim paedophile rapist gangs, or, you know, politicians that have, how can we put it, conflicts of interest that they don't declare, like, let's say, shares in companies for vaccines and masks that they then impose on the public and make us pay for in their tax and they profiteer from. We can have investigations into that. So, yeah, that's one of my main aims.
I guess a crucial question to ask at this point is, how can people help?
Now, the White Indigenous Rights Alliance isn't just the Our Rights Division. It's got four divisions with 12 departments, not including its commercial activities. As you can understand, this takes a substantial amount of setup, particularly as we are coming up with our own curriculum within the Our Futures Department. It's called the NEST Department's Education Hub. Going to cover three particular topics or criteria: history, culture, and counter-critical race theory. Now, we're creating our own educational resources, including animations. We're creating digital games, live worksheets, instructions for educators. We're going to need all kinds of things. Obviously, there's a massive website that's being built for all of these things, and we're having to test out software applications, see which open source applications we can use, because funding this myself at this point. So, you know, I have to limit the amount of costs, but I've got a good team of people. I wanted to recruit more people, but it was actually more complicated. At the moment, I'm writing every single one of the role descriptions, and I'm writing every single one of the department division plans in detail so that I can delegate better to others. And then, you know, I can concentrate on my studies and the litigation that I've got underway more. But you're going to see many videos in the new year. I'm going to start off with the Our Futures Department, or Division, sorry, then the Our Heritage Division, then the Our Rights Division, then the Our Communities Division. That's how the recruitment is going to go. And if you want to know more about those particular divisions and departments within them, like I've said before, there is a YouTube video that goes into detail about this.
All right, yeah, I'm just adding your YouTube link to the... Here is the...
Thank you. It's called An Introduction to the Alliance.
Yeah, and yeah, that's there. What about donations, financial support? Do you need that?
One of the problems that I've got, which is, you know, one of the reasons why I'm talking about access to justice, is because I've been ordered to do certain things by the courts, which will probably be out of my financial capabilities. Now, I don't feel that it's right for the courts to impose certain orders, costs, or whatever at certain stages of litigation that would then create an obstacle to access to justice for the majority of people, especially disadvantaged people within our society. And it's quite clear from Lord Diplock's judgment within the case that I mentioned earlier, the Attorney General versus Times in 1974, that even an act of parliament, like the, let's say, the civil procedure rules, can't in effect impede our constitutional right to access to justice without it being unlawful. It would have to actually state within that act or legislation, and would have to be passed by royal assent, stating that it limits the king's citizens' rights to access to justice, and none of these acts do. So at the moment, I'm able to fund this independently by myself. I haven't had to rely on funding for it, but I might need to get an independent medical examiner's report. But even if I had the money to do so, they won't take instruction from unrepresented parties. I've pretty much tried everywhere, so that's creating a problem for me. When it comes to the White Indigenous Rights Alliance, I will start taking funding as soon as the website and other things launch. I don't want to tell people what we're going to do. I want to show people what we're going to do. So before we launch, I want a lot of things in place and it's going to be a very professional organization. It's registered with Companies House. People will be given role descriptions. It's very formalized. There are CRM systems. It's not something that we're just rushing into. So once the website goes live, there'll be options for donation and options for subscription and obviously options for membership as well, because I need a membership backing, because when I bring forward things like judicial reviews, if you've got a membership behind you rather than just being a lone person, one independent activist, that holds much more weight. That's why you see so many organizations like Hope Not Hate, for example. You know, they will contest judgments. I've seen it with a young, I think one of those poor young autistic lads who's being convicted of being a terrorist for owning the anarchist cookbook. They thought that the sentence was too lenient for that poor teenage boy, and Hope Not Hate appealed it and demanded that he be given a more harsh sentence. And they can do that because of the weight of power that they have. So it's time that we started working together to give ourselves organizations that have that power and weight that they do.
Oh, look, I completely agree. And it takes somebody who is who has the character for this. You know, if I tried to do this, it would be I'm too much of an introvert. And I think a lot of us in the movement are like that. And that's the problem. You know, it's a matter of how much can you overcome your own nature in order to do something. I think it takes someone like you, who's much more of a woman of action.
I don't like working with people.
But clearly you are. You have a tremendous get up and go. I mean, that's very obvious.
I mean, I'm starting to like it because I see the value of my team and, you know, the things that they can do that I can't or I wouldn't want to have to teach myself. And it gets lonely sometimes. I think all nationalists can agree with that, you know, in activism. So it's nice to have other people around. But naturally, I have low trust levels with humans, so I like to operate independently. But lone wolves cannot take down big game. So we need to run together as packs and come together organized and decide to take down this monster that we face. I will say unfortunately, but I'm starting to like it. It means that we have to start working collaboratively and cohesively together with multiple different organizations. Because what we see a lot in nationalism is organizations trying to compete with each other and arguing with each other rather than collaborating and working towards our shared objectives.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, I think a phrase that a lot of people could do to learn is a high tide raises all ships, because you want an atmosphere of cooperation, positivity, optimism, not one of where we're competing against each other. I mean, that just creates a terrible atmosphere, I think.
Oh. You know, it's central to European nature, though. One of the reasons why we've excelled in so many areas is because of white men's competitive nature. So, you know, when you've seen European countries, one European country makes a gigantic monument or a spectacular palace, and then the royal families or the aristocracy of other nations think, oh, well, we've got to keep up with them. It's almost like the keeping up with the Joneses. Or even in a more primal way, it's European men tend to be motivated by women and love and desire, and that is what pushes them to greatness, to the greatness of creativity, to the inventive genius. That's why we ended up with great cities and other civilizations have mud huts.
Well, yeah, it reminds me of a joke I once said on Twitter. I would critique African architecture, but that would be hut speech. Back in the day. just one of
did
those
that get
puns.
You banned?
No, that didn't get me. That was something else. Actually, what got me banned was simply saying that black men commit more violent crimes. I think it was the phrasing. I said black men are more prone to committing violent crime than white men are. I think that was the exact wording.
That's statistically evident.
It is. But I think it was because I said prone, as if they don't really have a choice in the matter. They're just, you know.
I would argue that it is genetic.
Well, I mean, I suspect it is as well. There's the warrior gene and the I can't remember all the details. I used to know this stuff, like higher testosterone. There was something called estradiol that was involved. I can't remember now.
You have a completely different genetic composition. I mean, they'll even admit this in science journals, but when you point out that this actually makes us different hominid species, they start to get a bit fussy. But they'll admit that Europeans, for example, are 98 to 99% Cro-Magnon and 1 to 2% Neanderthal. You know, people keep saying that humans can't be cross species, but they'll admit that Europeans actually are. That's one thing that gets me. But Africans actually have 20%, up to 22% of their genetic composition that comes from a super archaic hominid. They think it's like Homo erectus or Homo habilis. And this is completely absent in white Europeans and Asians.
It's they're the only ones who have it. So it's, I mean, I don't know if we are 99% Cro-Magnon. Is that true?
Yeah, 90, but, well, it depends. The European variation is up to, I think, 2 to 3% typically of Neanderthal genetic composition, which means it's very possible for hybrid humans, basically, different versions of hominid, archaic hominid, to have mated and created hybrids, because all of humanity today are actually hybrid species.
Yeah.
Which they will admit when they say, oh, look, these Asians have a higher rate of Denisovian. But when you say, right, so we have different genetic composition, different genetic innate behaviors, very different physical attributes, right? You know, if we were to take a mixed race child, right, do you know this, that they can't take bone marrow or blood transplants from either parent because they're non-compatible. They have to get it from another mixed race person of the same genetic composition. And this is because we are actually hybrid species, and new hybrid species can't be genetically compatible with other hybrid species. But everybody on this planet is a hybrid.
Yeah, I remember hearing at some point that if you walk down the street, any random English person that you pass or British person has more in common with you than your mixed race child has in common, because the genetic distance is so great. Obviously you don't have a mixed race child, neither do I. I'm speaking hypothetically. That is a scary thing. I mean, it's obvious when you think about it. Of course they do. Any white person is going to be more genetically similar to you. And this is why it's kind of tragic when parents of mixed race children say, doesn't he look like me? You can see, it always breaks my heart when they say that. But anyway, it's a thing that I try to discourage. I have always tried to discourage it because I think it's just not the best thing. And just one reason why it's not a good idea is, as you've just said, they can't receive bone marrow. Yeah, just medical.
It
goes to show how ridiculous it is when lefties say, oh, we're all the same under the surface.
The NHS will put out adverts saying we need more mixed race people, more Asian people, more black people to be blood donors, to be bone marrow donors, because, you know, there are a lot of patients and they're not compatible with the white people's donations. And it's like, we're all the same. I mean, did you know there's actually more genetic disparity between us and Africans than there is between wolves and coyotes? And yet we're classed as the same species. Even Darwin, who, you know, I don't actually agree fully with all of his theory, but even he said we should be classified as different species. I mean, people forget that, you know, about a century ago, that the vast majority
of fucking love science
are still in the Stone Age. Sorry.
I interrupted with a crass joke, but anyway.
No, go back. I missed the crass joke.
I said, you were talking about Darwin, and I said, I fucking love science. There we go. Because it's the kind of people who will go on about Darwin, you know, science, that means that God is not real. But then as soon as you get into this stuff, they shit a brick, you know. That's not true. That's Darwin was a racist white man. He was a white supremacist, and you know, although he didn't know what he was talking about, but you know, according to Survive the Jive, the latest genomic research actually confirms what Victorian racists were saying. They're called racists now. People who were discussing race,
scientific racism. This is what they call it, scientific racism. So anything scientific that displays facts that aren't what goes along with the Afrocentric Jewish ran agenda, they'll call it racist. So, you know, if you point out that on average blacks have lower IQs than Europeans by a massive disparity, they'll call that scientific racism, and it's not progressive enough, and we need to measure it in different metrics like emotional IQ.
Well, this is the thing, you know, they'll say the IQ test is Eurocentric, and, you know, there's the thing about East Asians out competing us in it, but then also where is the intelligence test where Africans do better than you? Like, show me one. There isn't one. You know, so you couldn't, I don't know what you'd have to do in order to make the IQ test not Eurocentric in that way.
The best study that I've read was by Witches, Dolan and Vandermass. I don't know whether it's still available. I've seen rebuttals to it that are available on normal search engines. But that concludes over 30 years of study into race genetics and IQ. And it estimated the sub-Saharan IQ at around 68. An average, anyway. But it didn't actually classify Europeans as the highest IQs. It was East Asians and Jews. So how can that be European, you know, Eurocentric, when it's basically saying East Asians and Jews are smarter than Europeans, but Africans are basically at a retarded level?
Yeah, it's just a
higher IQ.
It's just absurd. Exactly. Our own test shows us to be not the highest race in that respect. So,
there is a disparity between the different ethnic groups of Jews. Like, apparently the Ashkenazis are the ones with the higher IQs, and then there are Sephardic. Yeah, around 98 to 100. But did you know that European IQ has been dropping over the last couple of decades, like the average? They're thinking that the average might drop below the hundreds within the next generation. How concerning is that?
It's frightening. It's really frightening. And I don't know, you know, when they say European IQ.
Yeah, but they might mean Africans as Europeans.
Exactly. They might be talking about people who happen to be in Europe
today.
Yeah, we
need to know whether it's white IQ or whether it's European.
Yeah, exactly. The trouble is that even that would be regarded as racist. You know, if you were to, you know the situation in France where they can't even collect racial statistics.
We're not allowed to collect information anymore. The Office of National Statistics have said that from now on, they won't conduct in their census any kind of survey as to the ethnic origins, nationality and birthplace of the peoples resident within the United Kingdom. And with no explanation, as far as I'm aware, which is basically, we want to keep you in the dark about your genocide and ethnic replacement.
Exactly. That's what it is. They don't want people to be able to quantify, to be able to say, here it actually is.
In other ways. So, you know, they're not going to get around that. There's data that's available, and you can use that to...
Even in France, they do it. I think it's with septicemia or something. They work out that, there must be this percentage of black people in the population because of it.
And then, you know, collate that against other data and come up with inferences as to how much the population has grown in certain ethnic groups from those inferences from this other data. All available through open source intelligence network tools.
Yes. We could obviously, there's a lot to say about this stuff. We could talk about it all night. We decided beforehand to keep this fairly upbeat.
Yes.
It's a grim topic, and people can see, and this is the thing, people can see the evidence really everywhere now. I mean, and it's probably going to increase as well, because they're talking about putting refugees in small towns, but it's already the case that you really can't white flight anymore. I think that has been the solution for white people. It's just to get away and then, you know, run away from the inner city, go to some nice wee village, and then tell yourself that diversity is great. That's what white people have done for, I don't mean all of them, obviously, but certainly a substantial percentage, have done for decades. And I think that's no longer a feasible solution.
It seems that prediction of the same evils that you turn a blind eye to will grow and come for you I've told people, I mean, white flight, I understand it, you know, especially once you have a child, you don't want them growing up in an area that's diverse. So you want to go to an area that's more white. But as a white person that realizes what's going on, or a nationalist, you feel quite limited in your options as to what kind of solutions there are. So you want to look after your immediate family, or, you know, first, most, more than anything. So most people want to get to an area with low crime rates and less diversity, because those two things go hand in hand. More white people, less crime. More brown and black people, more crime. So, you know, I understand why people run away to the countryside, but it is a bit like, you know how toddlers, when they're scared of a monster, they cover their face and they think that it's gone away because they can't see it. It's like that. You know, just because you're not seeing what's going on in our cities and the places that are affected doesn't mean that it's not happening. And now it's going to land on your doorstep and you're not going to be able to ignore it anymore. Is it getting serious enough for you now to do something? All these, you know, middle class people are okay with the white working class being ethnically displaced from their hometowns. Like, where are the Cockneys now? Where are they?
Yeah, oh, they're all
gone, right? Yeah, they're replaced by Africans and Arabs. But, you know, it's only when it gets to the posh towns that have expensive houses that you all start to care.
And the thing is that the system makes that happen, because, it, as you said, it puts them up in hotels, it puts them up in, it pays the rent, the Serco and all that. So, and they're looking, the government are looking to put them into these areas. So, I mean, you think that's kind of self-defeating for the government, because you're going to get the middle, you're going to get the people who can write a good letter. They're going to start getting pissed off in a big, big way. Because of this, because it's not, you know, little Jocasta isn't going to be able to walk to school anymore safely. This is already happening. And it's a weird decision on the part of the government, but I guess
it's an acceleration plan. I think, you know how kids test their luck on how much they can get away with? I think the globalists have thought, right, how much can we test these white people? How far can we push them? And they pushed well past what any reasonable person would hang their government for. Our government have participated in acts of genocide against our people. Even if people didn't believe it about the Muslim paedophile rapist gangs, that's genocidal. The population replacement, that's genocidal. But a lot of people started to notice during the COVID nonsense, right? You know, people started to notice that their freedoms and rights were being limited over things that they didn't really believe was going on, and there was no solid evidence to it happening. People have been jabbed and people are dying. People got locked up in their homes. Basically, your rights and freedoms went away like that, didn't they? And I think that woke a lot of people up. But at the same time, people complied for the most part. People have sat there silent as our nations have been invaded. We've got an Indian prime minister. We've got a Pakistani mayor of London. You know, back when I was a kid, terrorism didn't exist. Now it's like an occurrence that has 2 days in the newspaper. Everybody accepts it and moves on. You know, I go past schools and there's no white kids. We literally have them celebrating in the media that there's going to be no white men by the end of the century. And yet people still deny what's going on. People still deny it.
And I know.
I think it's starting to wane somewhat. From what I've gauged from, let's say, trying to test my theories as much as I can, because you know, like, I'm cancelled from everywhere, like everywhere. But one of the examples is the video that went viral on Twitter, 660,000 something views. And 99.9% of the comments on that were positive. And these were all normal people, because nationalists were all kicked off of Twitter at that stage. And people were saying it's about time someone stood up for white kids, for white people. And they were mentioning race, you know, and that's one thing that I've seen that's changed. There has been a racial conscious awareness that we are being attacked as a race, as white people.
Yes, I agree. I think this is something
that they're not going to be able to put away, a bit like a Pandora's box.
Well, hopefully, because, you know, they keep going on about race and they keep talking about racial groups. So at some point, white people, I think, are going to put two and two together and realize, well, why aren't we a group, and why doesn't our group matter and all that? But I agree with you that this is something that you can see. I mean, I'm not on Twitter, but I go there obviously I go there now and then and have a look around. And it's you can see that when something happens, it's just you don't get the Sivnat drivel anymore. And where someone does venture in with some Sivnat drivel, it's very quick. It's very thoroughly refuted by other people replying to them. So it's weird because Twitter is, as everyone knows, a highly, even under Elon Musk, it's a very censored environment. And yet this stuff is still happening. It's a very tangible change compared to 5 years ago.
Without the censorship woes. Imagine if people like me and you were allowed on normal platforms, we're allowed to debate these lefties on a fair and even platform. If our opinions were given the same reach as theirs were, what do you think the result would be?
Oh, we would win. I mean, this is why they had to deplatform everyone, because they can't answer our arguments. Their tactic has been for quite a long time now, to simply not even dignify them with a response.
You evil Nazi, you don't deserve a platform. I'm not even going to answer you.
Exactly. You're just evil. You're just spreading hate. You're just uninformed, malicious, etc. So I don't need to answer the completely cogent and truthful things that you are saying. And, you know, that works when you've got the power of the media behind you. But it doesn't work on social media. Because, and, you know, it happened with me when I was on Twitter. You could refute someone quite easily and get more likes than their original boneheaded tweet. And I think that, I think they noticed.
But, you know, you got a lot of suppression, though. What they call shadow banning. So suddenly a reach would just drop off and you think, hey, I was getting, like, interaction of, like, 100 people a day on one tweet and now it's gone down to 20. What's happened here?
Yeah. And of course, because of the way people are, that does discourage you. It demoralizes because, okay, I'm not getting the same. It's not having the same effect. So it's like your voice has been reduced to a whisper. You're trying, but it's just not reaching the same people. And it
demoralizes me somewhat. You know, the more they try and ban me, the more motivated I am. But it's not like one of those impulsive things. It's just like, oh, you think you can ban me, you can cancel me, you can exclude me from things. You wait, because you're not going to be able to ban what I do pretty soon. It's all going to be in the mainstream, and you're not going to be able to really contest that without me bringing some serious litigation against you. So, yeah, let's see how that works out for you guys. But, yeah, it's like my Telegram is now, my main Telegram channel has been going down by 10 subs a day exactly for months and months now, and it's ever since they censored it. So I don't know whether they just start removing subs, but I was like, even Telegram. So Gab seems to be the only platform right now that isn't censoring me at all.
All right. And I hope that your Gab is linked there so people can find you there. I've also added I will add the YouTube link in the description. But there is also Telegram. I mean, I know what you're saying about Telegram, and I think this is actually Apple who do this. Somehow they can, I don't know how the hell they do this. It sounds weird, but they somehow are able to censor individual channels on Telegram specifically, even if Telegram doesn't do it themselves. It's very strange. And Apple are, we all know, I think we've all seen, I think his name's Tim Cook, driveling about how there is a need for censorship and you aren't welcome on our service and all that stuff. So it's not surprising, but it is annoying that Telegram isn't immune to this stuff for sure, because for a while, I mean, and generally speaking, still now, it does seem to be genuinely interested in freedom of speech. But as you say, Gab is, I think, going to be the ultimate, the final sort of resort.
That's off to Torba.
He really is.
Was mocking Elon Musk even before Elon Musk invested in Twitter. He was like, the Jews will stop him. The Jews will stop him from implementing freedom of speech. And then it was like, we're going to have freedom of speech. And then the Anti-Defamation League had a word with him. And it was like, we're going to ban some people and some things. So have you returned to Twitter?
No, in fact, only today my appeal was finally answered. I appealed, I don't know, 3 weeks ago or something, 4 weeks ago, and they finally got back and they've said no. So, yeah, it seems to be quite random. I'll tell you the thing.
Did they give you a reason? Did they give you an explanation?
I'll find it for you. I'll read it out to you since you've asked. Your account is suspended or locked. Hello, your account has been suspended and will not be restored because it was found to be violating Twitter's terms of service, specifically their Twitter rules against hateful conduct. It is against our rules to promote violence against or directly attack or threaten other people on the basis of blah de blah. Additionally, if we determine that the primary purpose of an account is to incite harm towards others on the basis of these categories, that account may be suspended without prior warning. So I don't know which of those it is. They're not even telling me. Do they think that the primary purpose was to incite harm of the Millennial Woes account? Or are they saying that I directly threatened or attacked or promoted violence against people? I have no idea. And I just don't give a shit anymore. I'm very detached from it. As long as I can reach, you change. And this is something that probably isn't relevant to you, but it's something where when you get deplatformed from the mainstream, you have to adapt to that. You can't just keep going as if you're doing the same thing anymore, because you're not. You're not reaching the general public. So you have to change and find a new way of doing it and finding a way of doing it that is fulfilling for you. So that's what I've tried to do. And so as for... If I could get back on Twitter or YouTube, I would, but I'm not going to hanker after it. So sorry I interrupted you.
It's annoying. When you get accounts deleted, especially things like if you had a Facebook account for a decade and you've got pictures of friends and family and events when you're younger, and then they erase all that. It's more the loss of memory and some contacts that you're a bit pissed off about. I've never really been a content creator or anything like that, but I've always had an online presence. And it was more not being able to communicate with people that I didn't know outside of those platforms and hadn't shared other forms of communication with, and losing memories that were stored within those particular platforms that bothered me. But I feel more free with being able to speak on the platforms that I am on now, whereas you didn't before. You were always like, if I type what I'm going to say, I'm going to be on a 30-day ban, but I want to say it anyway. And then you type it and you're like, fuck, I'm banned for 30 days. And that used to really piss me off. But now I don't have to worry that something that I've put out there is going to give me 30 days of not being able to communicate with the people I'm regularly communicating with. So, having that regular ability to actually communicate with the people that I regularly do, I appreciate that. Even if Telegram wants to keep removing subs, it's fine, Telegram, it's fine.
This was happening to me all the time on Facebook, and I did actually I screenshotted each time it happened, because I don't know, I guess I was sort of taking a perverse pride in it at the time, but I can't find it. Oh, here it is, zucked.
Were you getting your, Facebook badges?
Oh, dear. Oh, all right. I'm not gonna. I was thinking I'll put them up on screen, but I don't think I will.
You've thought twice.
Yeah, they are actually quite excessively based. I'll send them to you afterwards. You'll get a good laugh.
Is it one of those where you look back and you go, actually, that one might have been justified? You see, quite often I posted things where I thought, oh, this is going to give me a ban. This is going to give you a ban, and then nothing. Right? And then something that's quite innocuous in many ways, something that you don't expect to offend people, and then boom, you're on a 30-day ban. And you're like,
yes.
Ooh. But like I said, I've not been on normal social media for a very long time. I've never liked Twitter anyway, because I'm a long-winded person. I find it difficult to articulate what I want to say in a very limited amount of words. So Twitter wasn't good for me. I think it leads to petty arguments. But what I'd like to do is actually engage in polls and respond to some things, but I don't think that would be a major platform for me. I don't expect to let them to let me back on, because I was posting a lot about how the different races are different species, and apparently that's really banned.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I would use the term species, because that just invites them to some would say it's, I mean, it's, see, the word species is actually quite nebulous, because there are in some cases there are different species that can procreate, that can reproduce together.
Well, there are mammalian species, it's quite common, and it's obvious. And then, with hominid species, we can, like, procreate with other species. Otherwise, we as white Europeans wouldn't exist. Like I said before, 98% Cro-Magnon, 1-2% Neanderthal. If hybridization couldn't exist, then we wouldn't already exist as a people. And we can't argue. It's like if you've got a lion and a tiger, for example, these are both big cats. They're both cats. They belong to the same genus, the cats. And it's like Africans belong to the same genus. They're humans, they're hominids, they're the same kind of thing, but they have different genetic composition coming from different archaic forefathers that evolve completely separately from one another. And we know that because we're lacking the genetic composition that came from Africans. So we couldn't have evolved from them, and we couldn't have mated with them at a former stage. In fact, it's quite clear that Cro-Magnon mated with Neanderthal, and then that mixed hominid species, this hybrid species, then went into Africa and mated with this super archaic species like Homo erectus, and created some of the modern hominid species in Africa. They have the actual most hominid diversity, because there were so many different, like, mini ethnic groups of Africans. But categorizing them as different species is accurate. Different species can mate, they can produce fertile, viable offspring. It's like male ligers, for example, are infertile, but female ligers are not. There was one in a zoo in Germany that's given birth twice now. It was impregnated by a lion, I believe, a male lion, and it was a female liger. And we see hybridization across the world. In fact, it's a major part of how evolution happens, believe it or not. But with whenever you get hybridization, they are never accepted into the species group of either the species that they are hybridized from. So a liger wouldn't be accepted into a pride of lions, for example. I mean, tigers are solitary anyway, but
and this is how you get
happens with monkeys. They don't.
This is how you end up with the Afua Hirsch situation, where she just doesn't belong to the Ashkenazi. She doesn't belong to the Norwegians. She doesn't belong to the English. And so she wants these groups to be nullified because she doesn't fit in. She doesn't have a group. I mean, it's a thing. Sorry, I interrupted you.
A sense of jealousy of a sense of identity. I mean, most white people don't have a collective sense of identity anymore. Many people find it hard to identify as a indigenous white person, or that they're part of a unique racial, ethnic, national, or religious group. But other groups don't really struggle with that so much. I think, you know, like as we were saying before with the mixed race peoples, I think it's quite cruel in the way of confusing them and making them make a choice in the way of their identity, because I don't think they actually really get a choice. Because if you look at how collective consciousness works, I think everybody accepts that to be white, you have to be purely white. And if you're mixed race, you'll be accepted as black rather than white. And most mixed race people will call themselves black. And I think that that's accepted. But in many ways, I've met many mixed race people, and I know many nationalists won't like this, but particularly those that have been brought up in white areas by their white families because the black dad disappeared when they were like a baby, or, you know, as soon as they'd impregnated the woman, they actually really appreciate white people because they've grown up in that environment and then seen other black people and thought, whoa, you know, this is terrible. So I've met a lot of pro-white mixed race people, but for the most part, most of them identify with the black part of their identity. But there must be some sense of not knowing who you truly are from that.
Yeah, it must be horrible. Yeah, I wouldn't, I mean, I don't think it's the end of the world, and it's important to say that, but I don't think it's not optimal. It's far from optimal. I think it's better if people have a solid sense of who they are. I mean, it's just unbelievable that we even need to say this. But I guess the liberal answer to that would be, well, they do know who they are. They're individuals. They're that special, unique person. But,
humanity's not really the point.
Sorry, go on.
I think humanity's at a point in time where less people know what and who they are than ever before. Men don't even know if they're men. Women don't know if they're women. People can be, or is it non-binary and decide day by day? An African can identify as an Englishman just by nature of being in our homeland. I mean, the entire sense of identity has been undermined. And I actually call it the psychological warfare of identity politics. And the idea that, you know, foreign, genetically foreign peoples and foreign species are European is a form of identity psychological warfare. But also this gender politics that we've been seeing, where they're confusing men as to the reality that they're men and women to the reality that they're women. It's a form of psychological warfare, because fundamentally, to understand the world, you first have to understand yourself. And people don't even understand what they are. People can't even tell you what a woman is these days, for goodness sake.
Well, that was the whole thing. Was Matt Walsh's, I thought it was a very well-chosen title, What is a Woman? Regardless of the obvious complaints about Matt Walsh and whatever.
I thought it was a good documentary. It's one of the very few mainstream ones that I've watched recently, but it was very interesting.
Oh, yeah. And the thing I really liked, the bit that I found the most interesting there was that guy. I'm fairly sure he was gay, sort of effeminate. He was being interviewed by Matt Walsh. And his answer to every question was just to ask another question. He could not give any clear answers. He was like, just refused to.
Was that the blonde one?
Yeah, I think he was blonde. And it was in a sort of office. It wasn't very well lit, if I recall correctly. It was sort of dark. And and the guy was just constantly, all he knew to do was deconstruct. And I think there are academics, I'm fairly sure he was, you know, Gentile. I think there are academics who just know nothing but that. That's all they've been trained in. So, sorry, what did you say there?
Yeah, I mean, my view on academics, you know, a lot of the, it's like when they get experts and scientific experts, I mean, these people are basically trained Marxists. I mean, universities these days are not really educational institutions. They might teach people certain skills that they might need for certain areas that they might want to work in, but predominantly it is teaching them how to be compliant Marxists in all areas of life, particularly in the workplace. You know, there isn't any area of education that hasn't been infiltrated and now utilized as an indoctrination system, and heavily so within universities. I mean, I don't believe that anybody comes out of university with the qualifications that they would like to, unless they have in some way capitulated to Marxism. In fact, the more Marxist you become, the better you will do, because it's not really a test of your intellect, it's a test of your compliance.
Yeah, I mean, that, I guess, brings us quite nicely to the matter that started you, that got you back into politics when your university discriminated. Do you want to tell that story? I think it's worth including in this.
Okay, so I'll try to keep to a short version of this. I went to the Open University because at the time I thought that would probably be the best option. I wanted to study online. I've got other things that I have to undertake. And due to certain events in my past, I don't quite have the educational qualifications that I would like to go to a big mainstream university. Also, I'm a mature student and not like 18 years of age. So I didn't think that this particular organization was going to be extremely Marxist. But when I signed up, unfortunately, when you start, it's Black History Month. I'm sure they do it actually twice a year now. But I got bombarded with all this Afrocentric propaganda, basically continuous disseminations of white people's history as being negative and oppressive, and the attributes of white people that they describe as whiteness being evil and oppressive and racist and needing to be eradicated or abolished. There was all this nonsense, you know, basically, that I felt was very derogatory, humiliating, and created a hostile environment for me as a white student. There was also opportunities that were only available to Blacks and ethnic minorities, like bursary schemes. There were support groups. What really irritated me was opportunities to meet potential employers for training contracts and internships, which you need to become fully qualified. And yet these were only open to Black and ethnic minorities. I mean, if you look at the people, the list of people that have been called to the bar, look at the names and you tell me how many white people have been called to the bar in the last few years. I mean, they are making it so that white people are excluded from positions of power and authority, particularly in law in our country. And I thought, I'm not paying you the same amount as a black or brown student to not be given the same level of access to opportunity, to not be given the same level of service, to be excluded from things that are supposed to make life easier for disadvantaged students, which I would be. And I brought these things up after I'd commented on a forum. It was an introductory law forum for new students, and they kept bombarding it with all this Black Lives Matter nonsense. And I left one comment that said, I find this unnecessary and divisive on a law forum for new students. And these Marxists cottoned onto that and basically doxed me, put a load of stuff on Twitter and went absolutely mental at the fact that I was questioning their support of Black Lives Matter and all this derogatory content towards white people. So I raised these matters with the university and said I was unhappy with many of the discriminatory policies, practices and provisions, that I wanted access to the same opportunities that non-white students had. And they basically disciplined me for stating that Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization, which it is. If you look at the Terror Act and you look at the definition of what is a terrorist organization, Black Lives Matter would certainly qualify. I mean, they've burned, looted, murdered on an international scale as well, to terrorize people into complying with their racial and political objectives as black Marxists. So yeah, they qualify as a terrorist organization, but I got disciplined for this. Obviously I contested that. And then there was another incident where I was told that I must accept that Sharia law is something that's going to happen in our country as part of diversity, and it doesn't matter that it undermines women's rights. And apparently me objecting to that was something to report me to Prevent for. And then they sent police officers to my house to come and ask me why I don't like Black Lives Matter. And I posted on another forum around Christmas time asking other white students, well, not actually white students, I didn't address it to white students, I asked other students to contact me if they felt that they were being racially or politically discriminated against by the university or their staff. And I was given another disciplinary for this. And I gave them so much opportunity to mediate and resolve these issues without going to court. I sent them the relevant legislation that they were breaching. I threatened I was going to sue them. They didn't believe me. And they kept trying to basically victimize me into what? Capitulating? Into saying, I'm really sorry, I won't say anything again. That's not going to work with me. You can't intimidate me into that nonsense. And I meant it when I said, I will sue the shit out of you. So they didn't believe me. I filed the claims in the courts. They then tried to get my claims thrown out as being emeritus and unsucceeded. In fact, their defense got thrown out for being insufficient. And I successfully defended the majority of my claims. I've now got another court hearing date on the 13th of June at Manchester Civil Justice Centre, Fanning versus the Open University. These are for two appeals. The first one's on a legal point, and I think that that's already settled. I'm not going to go into any detail on that. But the second one is about our constitutional right, our common law right, to access to justice, which is being impeded by our own justice system and acts of Parliament. And this is actually unlawful. If you look at, I think it's the Attorney General versus the Times newspaper, 1974, Lord Diplock's judgment within it, it clearly states that no act, no statutory act of Parliament, no form of legislation, no order of the courts can undermine our unimpeded access or right to unimpeded access to justice unless it has a clear declaration that that is what it does. It has to state that this act or this legislation has the right to undermine the king's citizens' rights to access to justice. But as we've seen, and I think we spoke about previously, if you're wronged as a citizen in this nation, unless you're incredibly wealthy or not white, you're unlikely to be able to afford to move forward with any form of litigation. You know, you have to raise hundreds of thousands of pounds. If you've got a mortgage on your house, your property's at risk, and we don't have anybody litigating for us. So they basically intimidate you into not moving forward, or in effect, prevent you from being able to access your legal rights or access justice through imposed cost. And this is unlawful. Everybody in this country, regardless of their economic capabilities, should be able to access the courts, not just access the courts, but be able to access remedy. And that includes things like independent medical examiner's reports. It includes things like courts not being able to impose costs or fees during proceedings. Even if the civil procedure rules state that, the civil procedure rules don't have a statement that they have the right to undermine our unimpeded right to constitutional right to access to justice. So even the civil procedure rules could be contested on that basis. So anyway, I'll have more to update on those particular proceedings from the 13th. If anybody wants to come and see that, the public gallery will be open.
So that's the 13th of January.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. 13th of January, 2023, 10:30 in the morning, Fanning versus the OU.
And that's at Manchester Crown Court.
Manchester Civil Justice Centre.
Civil Justice Centre, right.
It's a hearing for permission to appeal.
Right. Okay. Well, that's sort of a ridiculous story, and it could only happen in our time. And I think our grandparents would be completely baffled by the entire thing. What would you say is? I mean, do you feel that this is going to succeed, and what do you think will be the effects of it? Either way,
I think I will succeed. Personally, I can't really talk about a certain aspect of it. I don't think. I mean, I can tell you what my grounds of appeal, like the access to justice, but I can't talk about anything that's to do with anything to do with the defence, basically. That I don't think there's necessarily a law involved in that, but it's just classed as, you know, good legal practice. So I can talk about some of my side of things, but I can't talk about other things. Of course, I believe that I will be successful with my claims. They have sufficient legal basis. I have the correct case law, as far as I'm aware. There isn't anything that supersedes it in any way. And I'm willing to take it as far as is necessary. And so far, I've been highly successful in my litigation against them. So we'll see what happens. I'm more than happy to take it. I'm very happy that it'll be going to the higher courts, because now it has the opportunity to set some precedent.
Yeah, a legal precedent, exactly. I think it's ironic, because this all happened after you left UKIP and the world of politics, and you were looking to move on with your life and forget about all of that stuff. Yeah. But then that stuff came to you. It came back to you.
Why did you just have to irritate me again? It would have been very much in their own interest just not to fuck with me.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like it. Well, so I mean, you're going to war, that, and that's great, and yeah, fantastic. So about the alliance, do you want to say any more about that before we wrap up? I think it'd be good to leave on a positive note there.
So the White Indigenous Rights Alliance, I believe it's a very positive organisation. It's unlike anything that's ever existed before. Like I say, it's got four divisions with 12 different departments. The Our Rights Division is focused on policy, legislation and investigations. That could be into corrupt constabulary, politicians, or even into our own judiciary. There is a lot of information, like I say, in the introduction to the Alliance. Then, obviously, the Our Futures Division is what I'm going to be recruiting for very much in the near future. I need people who are willing to work as curriculum developers, particularly those with a good historical background, because I want you to fact check our curriculum before it is published. People who are very interested in countering critical race theory propaganda that is being bombarded upon white children to make them feel guilty and ashamed of their white skin and heritage. We want to install a sense of pride in their unique racial identity. So what we're looking for is people who can come on board as curriculum writers for the three main topic areas: culture, history, and counter-critical race theory. We're looking for animators, people that can use animation software. We're also looking for graphic designers. I'm looking for voice actors, and I'm looking for videographers. And this is to build that particular curriculum within that area. There are other divisions and departments, of course, and all of that is detailed in the introduction to the Alliance. If I try and go through it all now, we'll probably go on for like another 20 minutes or so. So I think it's best just to refer people to that. But I will be producing more in-detail videos and what I would call recruitment videos in the near future in relation to all of those activities that need to be undertaken before I can launch this organisation, which I expect to launch around September or October of next year.
All right. And how can people contact you if they want to help out?
You can get in contact with me at info@weara.uk. That is connected to the Weara website, which hasn't launched yet, but will do well around the time that we launch the company, because I don't want it sitting there dormant whilst our activities are still underway, our initial activities. Or you can contact me by @ing Paris at any of my chat groups connected to my Telegram and Bubba Kate's Gab. I believe you can message me on there. I've seen messages on there, and I don't think I've got any restrictions. So if you want to get in contact with me through those platforms, please feel free to do so.
All right. Excellent. All right. I guess that's all that we need to say. There are some super chats, so I'll put them to you now. Okay. Black Pigeon Pilled. Okay. J. Ray says, love you, Kate. Merry Christmas, you fox, you.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. It's getting cold in here. I turned the heating off a while ago, and I'm sorry.
All right. Lady of Shalott says, greetings to Kate. Huge respect for Kate. She gets out and does things in real life. The situation in the UK is the worst I've ever seen in my lifetime. Does Kate think a collapse in the UK will come? Are the British people too broken to fight back now? Blessed Christmas to you and yours.
I think economic collapse, or at least a really big recession, is on the cards. And I'm aware that the fuel prices are supposed to go up in February or March, might make it difficult for some of our logistics companies to continue. The assault upon farming is going to cause significant problems. So who knows? It seems to me that our own populations have become so docile that I've given up hope of any real civil unrest that is against the legitimate injustices that we're facing. But one can always hope. British people tend to get more pissed off when they're cold and hungry.
Well, that's certainly true. All right. Night Nation Review says, Kate is the best. Her organisation gives our people in the UK serious hope that they may have a future in their own country and not be subjugated to the interests of others. So, yes, thank you for that, Night Nation. Irish Nationalist Media says, Kate is right. We need more professional organisations within the nationalist sphere, some specialising in lawfare. Nationalist NGOs like White Papers, and the only way we can do it with a bigger impact is consistent fundraising. One way is to create subscriptions to these groups with benefits for subscribers. Something to bear in mind. Soccer City says, where is the best physical place to meet very right-wing women? Is it church, the gym, a shooting range? What is your habitat, Kate?
I spend an awful lot of time at home in front of my laptop. I do go to the gym. I occasionally go to classical music events. I don't go to church because they literally have monuments to Marxism, like, you know, transgender flags and welcome Afghan refugee signs. So church is completely lost me. But I do believe that you will probably find a better quality of women if they are religious than you would do, let's say, somewhere like a bar or a nightclub. But trying to locate a woman like me is probably going to be quite difficult because we're few and far between anyway.
Yes, that is certainly true. But I think it's important to say,
Are out there. We are out there. So don't lose hope, guys. There are lots of beautiful, eligible white women just waiting for you gentlemen to come along.
Yeah, and I think it's important to say that they don't need to be politically based and red-pilled when you meet them.
Yeah, it's probably better that they're non-political. They just have to be traditional. You know, women, once they fall in love with a man, they're quite easy to manipulate into your political views anyway. Keep that.
Okay. All right. Black Pigeon Pilled says, what issues does Kate envision White Indigenous Rights Alliance to contend with when it's fully operational?
The worst thing would be I plan to bring four cases, private prosecutions, all kinds of civil litigations against various people and institutions that are undermining the rights and lives of the Indigenous population. If I were to lose one of those cases, that could be problematic for the White Indigenous Rights Alliance. It is a limited liability company, so a bit like some of these African charities, you know, after they fold, all I would have to do is to create another one. So I'm not too bothered. I've written some pretty robust documents that limit our liability anyway. And like I say, as a limited liability company, it's like with UKIP, the worst thing that we faced was litigation. That cost so much money and nearly shut down the party. But they can't not allow me to do what I do and operate with the White Indigenous Rights Alliance, because there are thousands of companies that do exactly the same thing just for various groups of Black and ethnic minorities. Well, minorities, the world majority, you know, the people.
The
that
global majority, yeah, yeah.
Was it now 92% of the world's population?
Yeah, and it's a frightening phrase that, and I think it's perhaps intended to be, but let's not get into that because that's depressing.
Sorry, we're supposed to be blackpilling this evening. We're supposed to be married.
Yeah. And he also says, big respect. I get the impression it's extended far beyond the preview of I think he meant purview of university now, and it definitely sounds like it has. Hinchfoot says, there was a young lady called Kate who so bravely took on the state.
Become rude. Yeah, I can see from your giggle there, it might have become a little bit rude.
Yes, yes. I'll read it out anyway. It's quite sweet. A young lady called Kate who so bravely took on the state, but while talking with Wosey in his t-shirt so cozy, she wore a red dress to the date. It's quite nice. all right. Thank you for that, Hinchfoot. And then Black Pigeon Pilled says, Kate is our little Boadicea.
Oh, thank you. And she is one of the very few role models that I have in life. I mean, leaving the destruction horizon of your enemies, you've got to kind of salute that, haven't you? That's respectable. She might have lost in the long run, but she really, really took out her vengeance. And I like that.
Yes. Whityard says, thanks for a great stream. I appreciate your optimism and I'm hopeful for something good from the White Indigenous Rights Alliance. So there we go. Thank you for that, Whityard. All right. So is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
No, not really. Thank you, anybody that tuned in and watched this evening. Thank you to you, Woz, for inviting me on to Millennial. It has been a pleasure and very enjoyable. So thank you very much for having me on here. You must be exhausted, by the way, like with the amount of back-to-back streams that you've been doing. So I, you know, really do appreciate what you're doing for keeping the morale of nationalists up with this content, because at this time of year, it's just a bombardment of nonsense on TV. So there's little to watch. And this gives people a break from all of the media that's supposed to demoralize them. So thank you for creating all of this content and the effort that you and your team put in. And thanks for having me this evening. Again, if you want to contact me, Bubba Kate versus the state, if you want to find me on most social media platforms, if you type that in, the channels aren't closed. You can usually find me. If you at Paris in any of the chats or tell people that you want to communicate with me or just leave a message in there, I'll probably see it. Best place to get me for messages is probably Telegram. But if you'd message me on Gab, I will also see it. But yes, sir. Thank you very much and happy millennial, Paul.
And thank you. And Merry Christmas, Kate. And this has been a great stream. So, all right, I'll be back in about half an hour with the next stream, which I believe is Kiwi Off Gridder. Let me just check that. Yes, it is. But in the meantime, Baba Kate, thank you for appearing on Millennial. All right. See you later.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available in the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show. And spread the word.